Genesis 15, verses 5 and 6. And he brought him outside and said, "Look toward heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them." Then he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. Thank you. You may be seated. That is the word of the Lord.
I hope those didn't sound like ominous words from Joe, that you will not be standing for quite some time. It may be true. I may be a little bit longer than normal. If I am too long, we'll cut out the closing hymn and go right to benediction. So if that happens, don't panic. I have got a couple of announcements and then a question. Does everybody in the room have a map that wants to have a map? Because we will be using a map. If you do not have a map, just raise your hand and our head usher will get you a map. And this is Calvin Tattershall, and he's our head usher right over here. And because you'll want that. We don't need it just yet, but we have a couple of birthdays today. We don't normally, routinely, all the way in the back, Calvin. I see that hand. The buses will wait. Let's see. Rebecca and Mari are having birthdays today, this very day. So Mari is the Aldrich's daughter. And so if you don't know Mari, introduce yourself to her after the service. The second thing is that with the grace of God, my son will be graduating in 2 weeks. And we have some invitations. If you all would like to come to a meal following the graduation, I wouldn't wish the graduation on you. But if you want to come to the graduation, you're able to do that. But the food will be swell. So see Shay or Hawk after the service and collect your invitation. The last thing I want to announce before we jump into our introduction is this. We have, surprisingly, provide a lot of meals for people in our congregation when there's illness or when there's something that's holding folks back. And one of the things that we've been doing recently is that we have been scavenging the leftovers from Second Sunday Supper. And we have containers, and we put those on there, and we have access to a freezer. And so we're freezing those meals and then providing those, among other meals that are being cooked in time for that. So my point is, if you felt like cooking just a wee bit extra for next week, then we'd have a wee bit extra food for the meals that we provide. So you can just take that into account and do what you will. Today's sermon, before I pray, is going to be a little bit more of a lecture format than it will be an actual sermon, because it's going to be an introduction to the book of Exodus. And we will be, Exodus is a very large, daunting book. There are 40 chapters in Exodus. And I believe that I can get us through it in between 10 and 12 weeks. So we will not be here for the rest of our natural lives. But if you will keep your map in your Bible for the next few weeks at least, that will be helpful to you. So my apologies for the format today, and my apologies in advance, because I know that I'm going to go 6 or 7 minutes longer. I will look at the clock, but it's absolutely meaningless that I do so. So I just want you to be aware of that. Let's just pray very quickly, and then I'll tell you what we're going to do. Father in heaven, I ask that you would grant me the ability to be clear, that as I try to articulate a great amount of information, that it would not just seem academic, but it would be the backdrop and the cornerstone for that which we will learn in the coming weeks. Your word is rich and beyond compare, and I ask that you would give us eyes to see and ears to hear and the ability to stay awake and stay focused. And I ask this in Christ's name. Amen. If I notice too many of you nodding off, we'll stand in the middle of the sermon, do a few calisthenics, touch our toes a few times, and then just continue on. So it's a good exercise, and we'll do that. I want to do something first. We're going to have a PowerPoint presentation. We have more PowerPoint presentations today than we've ever had at Redeemer, so this should be very exciting. Technology at its finest. I want to talk to you about context. Context is the heart and the soul of understanding and being a good, solid Bible student. And so I want to explain a little bit about the way the context of the Bible works, and I'll explain why in just a moment. You know, some preachers will do one verse at a time. There have been some very famous preachers who have done that, and they're fine preachers and so on and so forth. And oftentimes, they will give you the context of that verse. A verse is found within a chapter. That's the next layer of context, if you will, is the chapter in which a particular verse is found. If a preacher's really doing his work and he's really trying to explain a particular book well, he'll say how that verse and how that chapter are found in the context of the book in which it's in, so that you have from start to finish the whole context. But you can take it one step further and say, where is that book found in the Bible, and how does it add to our understanding of the Bible as a whole? How does that book help us understand the Bible as a whole? And when we get to that level, we start to talk about themes, major themes that carry through the Bible from start to finish. Now, the reason that I'm bringing this to mind for us is that in the book of Exodus, we are introduced to some of the most critical themes in the whole Bible. As a matter of fact, I would say and I would argue that if we don't understand the themes of Exodus, it's going to be very difficult for us to understand the major themes of the Bible. You know, it's one of our, if we're fortunate, we had a good enough Sunday school education that we had some of the stories from Exodus taught to us. But those stories were not necessarily taught to us in the context of the Bible as a whole. So my goal in this study is to try to give us some of the major themes of Exodus and how they carry through the whole Bible from start to finish. So I'm hoping that this won't be boring to you, but that's why I wanted to introduce to you the idea of context. I will be doing some drawing for you later on, so I'll get the board clean now. Now, if you have your maps, go ahead and open those up. And I want to do a little bit of map work for us because I think it's very important to add to our understanding of the context by understanding the land of the Bible and understanding where some of the events of the book of Exodus take place. We really won't be doing a study where I'm going to trace the map and show you where the Israelites wandered through the desert, because quite frankly, there's a lot of controversy surrounding that journey. I'll make points that are obvious, and we know for sure this is where the Israelites were during their wanderings, but I want to do something before that in our map. The first thing that I want you to do is take one of your hands, I don't care which, and put it right there in that map so your fingers kind of touch that little blue, light blue box. Everybody see that? Then take your other hand and put it over here over the word Africa. Okay? Those are the two largest desert land masses in the world. You got the deserts in Arabia, you have the deserts in North Africa, the Sahara Desert. And right between those two deserts, right here in this region, right here where my finger is, everybody needs to find this because it's real important. That's Egypt. All right? So why is Dave pointing this out, and why does it matter, and who cares, and on. Well, let me say this. Even today, nobody in their right mind tries to cross these deserts on foot. I mean, the only people that are ever found there are the most hardened, hardcore Bedouins in the world. And anybody else that's crossing those deserts is being led across those deserts in modern machinery by Bedouins who have lived there their whole lives. What's my point? My point is that Egypt is between the two largest, most dangerous deserts in the world. Consequently, they're protected on those two sides because no army is going to go crossing those two deserts to get to Egypt. If there's a threat to Egypt, it's going to come from one of three places. One is most likely, and the other two are less likely. One would be if somebody wanted to attack Egypt from the north by coming in from the Mediterranean Sea. The other would be they could come up from the south, but it's really, really mountainous, very rugged, very challenging, and would be very hard for an army to get to Egypt from that place. The most likely place that Egypt is going to be attacked is from the north, but right along the coast into Egypt, across the Suez Canal into Egypt. But notice where they come. That blue box, that blue area, is the land of Israel. Modern Israel, now. Israel didn't exist, so to speak, in the time of the Exodus. But that's where the threats are going to come. Now look at Egypt again, and I want to point out why Egypt is such an attractive place to be. You notice right along the edge of the Mediterranean Sea, all those rivers that come down to the center part of Egypt. Egypt is lush, green, filled with water, and it's the best agricultural land in this entire region. So that northern part of Egypt there is where everybody wanted to live, everybody wanted to be, because that's where the crops were the best, where the grass was best for flocks. So you had sheep and goats and camels and everything else. That was the richest part of the world. So people wanted to get there. And that was the... Now, the interesting thing is that most northern part of Egypt is where Israel ended up settling. That's where Joseph came. That's where the nation of Israel was born, so to speak, and where it grew and where it developed, and that's where they had all the building done up there. I'll talk more about that in just a little bit. But I want you to understand why Egypt is such an attractive place to be. Because that's where the water is, that's where the food is, and that's why everybody goes to Egypt when there's a famine. Because that part of the world is like California used to be in the 30s and the 40s. It provided most of the produce for North America in one San Joaquin Valley. Well, that's kind of what that Fertile Crescent is in the northern part of Egypt. All right, so that's a little bit of background. Now, I've got to draw you another map, and not a map, but a very clever, clever design. Because this is going to lead us up to the dates for the Exodus. As you know, nations, any nations, has its highs and has its lows. Times when they exert a lot of power, times when they don't exert a lot of power, times when they are in control of their own destinies, and times when they are not in control of their own destinies. You can decide where we are now, where we have been, where we will be, but we have seen the rise and fall even in the States. We've seen it in Europe. We've seen it all over the world, and it was true for Egypt. Even though they carried all the great resources of the world, there were times when they really were down. So let's just draw something that looks like this. That's a high, that's a low, that's a really big high. And then there's a decline again. The event of the Exodus, the best data, and I mean the best data in the world, tells us that the events of the Exodus took place about 1500 BC, the 15th century BC. And so that's the kind of the time frame. And the events of the Exodus took place right about there. So let's say that's 1500. Joseph showed up in Egypt right about here, okay? There's a 150-year gap between Joseph and the events of the Exodus. But this was a time when Egypt was really, really, really in decline. As a matter of fact, Egypt wasn't even in control of their own destiny. The people that ruled that region during that period were a group of people called the Amorites. And the Egyptians didn't like the Amorites very much, for obvious reasons. Now, here's what's very interesting about the Amorites. They didn't conquer Egypt by military prowess. In other words, they didn't invade Egypt. They arrived in Egypt as immigrants. And they started to populate and live in Egypt. And they finally got to be so powerful that they took over the government of Egypt. And so they ruled Egypt for a very, very long period of time, kind of from the time that Joseph showed up on the scene and the time of the events of the Exodus. So what's the point, Dave? Who cares? Big, lousy deal. Well, the Amorites were a people very much like the Israelites. They looked like them. They came from the north. They dressed like them. They weren't Jewish, but they looked like them. See? So, you get to this point here, and Israel, Egypt is now back in power. They've thrown the Amorites out. They've killed a bunch of them. They've sent them packing. They've got them out of their country. They've got their power back. But Israel is now a great nation. Israel is a people. Israel looks very threatening. So Egypt is trying to figure out what to do with Israel. Now they've got two choices. They could do to Israel what they did to the Amorites, kill them and boot them out of their country, which is a very appealing option on a certain level. But at that time, Israel was serving as a really, really good labor force. And so they didn't want to lose that labor force. The second thing was that by keeping Israel in Egypt and dominating Israel and keeping them suppressed and keeping them slaves, Egypt showed the world that they were once again a dominant power. So they had this catch-22. They had this problem. They hated the Israelites because they acted and looked just like the Amorites, and they didn't want that kind of threat in their back door. But by the same token, it was awfully nice to have a bunch of people building buildings for you and building cities for you and doing a bunch of work for you. And if you kept them hungry enough and you kept them weak enough, they didn't pose as much of a threat. And that's the thing they failed to do with the Amorites. They didn't keep them down. They let them gain power. So this is kind of the context that's going on with the Exodus and so on and so forth. Okay, don't lose your maps. We're going to go back to that. Do you like the artwork? I mean, I'd be signing this and selling it later. But anyways, so we want to keep the map open. We're going to go there. But I want you all to turn to Genesis chapter 12. Because this is where the whole thing starts. Remember, Exodus is in the context of the whole Bible. And I want us to understand that context so that we can do justice as we plow ahead. Let me read the first four verses of Genesis chapter 12 and let you know what's going on. Now the Lord said to Abram, as you all know, Abram, his name is changed later on to Abraham. His wife's name was Sarai. Her name is changed to Sarah. We'll get back to that in a moment. Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. And I will bless you. And I will make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you. And I will curse those who curse you. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. So Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Okay. First theme of the Bible, major theme of the book of Exodus, God makes promises, and God keeps promises. Now he does not keep promises in our time frame. He doesn't keep promises in man's time frame, but he makes promises. And the question is he going to keep those promises? So he makes a promise to Abraham that you're going to be a great people, a huge nation. I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you, and through you all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. Where is Haran, you ask? Thank you for asking. All right, on your map. Look over here on the map. Everybody see where the pen is? That's Ur, Ur of the Chaldees. Haran is a little village in Ur. All right? So Abraham is told by God, I want you to travel. Now Abraham is mature. He's 75. He's a young guy, but 75. Because, but like I said, he didn't jump on an airplane from Ur and just fly across this desert. Because like I said, nobody in their right mind goes across this desert. He packed up everything he owned, his wife, his family, his slaves, and so on and so forth, and traveled all the way up here through the north, where you can see there's water, it's the foothills, there's food, But this wasn't a journey that took place over a week. This is hundreds of miles. And he's got a big entourage with him as he's traveling. So this was a slow journey. One of the frustrations for us when we read our Bible is, it says so-and-so did this, and then the next verse, the same person did something else, and we get the mindset that all this took place in one afternoon. This is not the case. So Abraham is told by God, and I'll just use Abraham instead of Abram, is told by God to travel over here. So what I'm saying is, the faith that Abraham demonstrated was pretty extraordinary. You know, he didn't say, hey, Dave, I want you to go to Salida. Which even that one would be a stretch for me if I had to walk to Salida. But he told Abram, you got to change everything. The number of people groups that you go through, the threat to your livelihood, to your possessions, to your family, all of this stuff, because you're going to be traveling through villages who may not be friendly to you. So Abram is showing at the outset a great deal of faith and demonstrating quite a bit. So let me continue and read a little bit further on. Abram took Sarah, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, and all their possessions which they had accumulated and the persons which they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. Now, Canaan is the blue box, in case there's different names for things. That's where Canaan is. So they set out for the land of Canaan, and thus they came to the land of Canaan. And Abraham, and I'm just going to call him that, passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem to the oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. Okay, now look in the blue box, because this is kind of a grand central station for Abraham. In the blue box, kind of right in the middle, you'll see the name Shechem. So Abraham travels from Ur of the Chaldees over to Shechem, and he's got all of his stuff there. So he doesn't yet know it, really, but he's in the land God has promised him that is going to become ultimately his land. So he's in Shechem, and that's where things are taking place. Then the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. So basically, we have this big gap in Abraham's journey. He ends up in Shechem. Then we are told that God speaks to Abraham again. Whether or not God had been speaking to him throughout the whole journey, we do not know. But this is the next account that we have, that God speaks to Abraham and says, "This is the land I promised." Now, it may have taken him a year, may have taken him two, not exactly sure how long it took him to get over there, but promise number one is being fulfilled. He's in the land that God has promised him. So he builds an altar. Verse 8, then he proceeded from there to the mountain on the east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east, and there he built an altar to the Lord. You can see those places in that blue box, and called upon the name of the Lord. Abram then journeyed on and continued toward the Negev. Now, we've all heard the word Negev and all of that kind of stuff. But the Negev is the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula. So Abraham continued his journey south, and he came. This is the Sinai Peninsula, that triangle right there. Okay, the triangle between Canaan and Egypt. So the next place Abraham stops is right there in the Sinai Peninsula, and that's where he's hanging out for a little bit, the Negev. Now, there was a famine in the land, so Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. See, he's not silly. You got a big family, you got a bunch of animals, you've got a bunch of slaves. Everybody needs to eat. So where do you go? You go to Egypt. Look again at the map. Look at all the rivers. Look at all that delta. That's the place that floods every year, and the soil is rich and it's deep and all that kind of stuff. When there's a famine, if you're able to, you boogie down to Egypt, because that's where you know that you can eat. And that's exactly what Abraham did. All right. Verse 11, it came about when he came near to Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, "Now listen, you're a beautiful woman. And they're going to know you're a beautiful woman. And so I want you to lie and say you're my sister so I don't end up dead." So Abraham's faith really flags and waves here. And what happens is his wife ends up in the hands of one of the pharaohs. The Pharaoh finds out that they're actually married, not brother and sister, and he boots Abraham and Sarah and the whole clan back out of Egypt, all right? So chapter 13, so Abraham went up to Egypt, to the Negev, and he and his wife and what belonged to him, and Lot was with him. Now Abraham was very rich in livestock and in silver and in gold, and he went on his journeys from the Negev as far as Bethel. So he went all the way down to Egypt to spare his family. He went through the Negev twice, and then he comes back up to Bethel. Now, Bethel is the place where he and Lot, his nephew, divided everything between the two of them. You may remember the story. He said, Lot, where do you want to go? And Lot lives over there, and it's real nice and green and lush. And he says, well, you know, Mom didn't raise any fools. I'm heading that way. Well, Lot went that way, and Abraham went this way, and Abraham prospered significantly. And he did very well where he went, despite the fact that that he was on the land that was not as rich and fertile as the land that Lot took. Now jump over to chapter 15, all right? After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abraham, I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. Abraham said, O Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? He said, the only heir I got is one of my slaves. I really like him, but he's not blood. And Abraham said, since you have given out no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who comes forth from your own body shall be your heir. And he took him outside and said, look at the heavens and count the stars if you are able to count them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. And he believed in the Lord, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. Okay, so one promise has been fulfilled. He's been spared. He's come back to Bethel. God still says this is the land. And God is adding meat to the promise that you're going to be a great nation and that you're going to have many offspring. Because now he tells Abraham, your clan is going to develop directly through you. Not somebody that you tell everybody is your heir, but you will actually physically have an heir. So the question is, and of course we know the story, Abraham says, I'm old, my wife is old, and she may be good looking, but she's barren, and her childbearing years are gone. How is this going to take place? All right, now, grab your bulletins. Bulletins. Does anybody need to stand up yet? Okay, good, because if somebody next to you is nodding off, feel free to poke them. All right, on the back of your bulletin, and this is very important. And most of us in this room may know this, but I want us to understand what takes place. I really want us to see how this is going to happen. God's made these promises to Abraham. God is a promise-making God. Will he keep his promises? And if he does, how is he going to do it? Now, we get bored because we think we know the story so well, but I mean, can you imagine a 75-year-old guy takes everything he owns, including his slaves and his family and all of his flocks, and travels halfway around his world to be spared in the land of Egypt, and then he comes back up to Bethel, and God says, this is your place. And God is now saying, you're going to have a son. All right. Well, we know that Abraham and Sarah got together, and they had a son whose name was Isaac. And it was a great day of rejoicing. I mean, he made a bunch of mistakes, Abraham did, along the way, but he has a son named Isaac. This Isaac is the son who is taken to the top of the mountain, and God says, I want you to kill him there. Fairly unlikely way to see a promise fulfilled. Abraham, in obedience, takes his son up, but of course he's spared, and another sacrifice is given to him. Isaac gets together with a girl whose name is Rebekah. She's also another very good-looking lady. And they had two sons, prominent sons, Jacob and Esau. Now, Esau, as you know, he was the guy that was hairy and liked to hunt and eat wild game and all those kinds of things. I hope my character is slightly better than Esau. But Esau became the father of the nation of Edom. And Edom was, has, and will continue to be a problem for Israel for the rest of time. And so there's Esau, but it was Jacob through whom God chose to continue to fulfill his promise. Now Jacob was an interesting fellow. He had some character flaws. He had two wives and two concubines, all of whom he had children with. He also lied to his father and stole stuff from his brother and, you know, a lot of different things. But he was the guy that God chose to fulfill his promises through. Very unlikely. If I was writing a story, it's not probably how I would write it, you know. But God does his thing his way. So he has 12 sons, and Jacob's name is changed to Israel. And his 12 sons become the 12 tribes of Israel. And one of his sons' names is Joseph. And Joseph is the one who is sold into slavery by his other brothers and who ends up in Egypt. And Joseph is the one who spares his entire family by calling them down in the midst of yet another terrible famine. I mean, we remember the story from Sunday school, but very quickly, Joseph finds the favor of the current Pharaoh, and he is the one who is given dreams, and he is the one who puts together a plan to storehouse food so that when a famine does come, not only will Egypt be spared, but his entire family will be spared as well. So Joseph is down in Egypt. He's just a sole guy, one guy. And he's the one that brings his whole family down. And it's that family, his brothers and his father, who become the nation of Israel. Now guess where where Israel lands. They land right, I got to remember the name, Tanis. You see Tanis right there on the north side there? Everybody see it? That became Grand Central Station for Israel. The heart of the richest, most fertile land in all of Egypt. That's where they prospered. That's where they became great. That's where their numbers grew, and so on and so forth. And that's where Joseph brought his entire family. If you look a little bit south, is this boring you guys? I hope not. Because, I mean, I'm just lit up. But anyways, just south of there, you can see Cairo. Okay? The modern-day capital of Egypt is Cairo. Right below the R in Cairo is where all the big, big, big pyramids are. Okay? That's where all the big pyramids are. The ones that we see on TV, the ones that we see pictures of, and so on and so forth. There's pyramids all over Egypt. They were all tombs. But that's where the predominant spot was that those big pyramids were. So more than likely, when Israel became slaves, what were they building? Well, I'm glad you asked. Right along the coast, up there, above the town that they're from, the Pharaoh, who was really wise, decided to build two cities. And the reason he wanted two cities there was because all the threats were going to come down the coast, and he wanted two cities that could fortify his resources so that if they were invaded, they could branch out and attack from those two cities. So what he did was put the Israelites to work building those two cities to defend against foreign invaders. So that's most likely what Israel was doing when they were making bricks with straw and so on and so forth. And so that's what was going on. So that's where everything took place. Now go to, trust me, we'll be done in an hour or two. Exodus chapter 1, please. You thought, we're never going to get there. So hopefully you can remember some of that. If you don't remember all the names, at least you remember kind of the context and story. Exodus 1 starts by reviewing all of this history. Now, we are terrible historians as a nation. Now, some of you know history, and some of you know more, much more than I do. You know, if I were to give an exam on the Revolutionary War, about the only thing I could say is we whooped the Brits, and that would be the end of the story. I'm not sure we could say a whole lot more about the Civil War, and our history is about that long. You know, Israel's history is about that long, thousands and thousands of years. As a matter of fact, on those two humps that I artistically drew, way before, 1,000 years before that first hump is when those big pyramids were built. So those pyramids were built 1,000 years before Joseph ever showed up in Egypt. But in Hebrew, in the Hebrew people's minds, history is everything. Their 1,000-year, 2,000, 3,000-year-old history is as alive to them as what happened to you and I yesterday. And so when they review history like this, and when the Bible continually says, your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I am the one who delivered you from the hands of the Egyptians. Those aren't just words. That is life to them. And that's how Exodus starts. Let me read the first few verses. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel. Remember, that was Jacob, and now it's Israel, who came to Egypt with Jacob, and they came each one with his household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. Now, okay, so we think, big deal, you named all these names. Everybody in Israel is a member of one of these tribes. So to mention this history is like to say, you know, I heard Joe earlier talking about his ancestors, that, you know, one came from Hungary, and you know, and one came from this place and that place. You know, most of us may not even know that much, but these guys, see, I'm from the tribe of Gad. This is my piece of dirt. That means something. So when they're reading Exodus, it's a flood of information for them. It's a flood. So anyways, all the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. And Joseph died and all of his brothers and all that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Okay? Now, verse 8. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He didn't know any of that history. He didn't know what Joseph had done. He didn't know that Joseph had saved the nation. He didn't care. All he knew was these people were like ants. But he knew the history of Egypt, and the last time there was a bunch of immigrants in Egypt, major, major problems. They had 150 years of domination. So what's this guy going to do? And how is this going to fulfill the promises of God? So a new king arose who didn't know Joseph, and he said to his people, behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, they will also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land. Why? Because everybody that would come from the north is going to have long black beards, just like all the Israelites. They're going to have darker skin, because you see, the Egyptians, they were fair, pretty boys. And so they, if those guys from the north come down, well, Israel, who's they going to side with? They're going to side with the boys from the north. We got to do something about this. We can't have another down period in our history. We're almost done, I promise. So they appointed taskmaster over them to afflict them with hard labor, and they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithon and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out. And so they were in dread of the sons of Israel. And the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. And so what happens is this Pharaoh is the guy that brings in the midwives from Israel and says, listen, I want you to destroy the babies that are born to these women who are male. And I just got to read this part, because I'm guaranteeing you, if you were a Hebrew reading this, you'd be laughing. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing? Because they were not killing the babies. And let the boys live. And the midwives said to the Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwives can get to them. It's really a kind of a slap in the face. In other words, well, Pharaoh, the situation is this. Your girls are pansies. And they want to be pampered, and they want to have their brows wiped with cold claws and ice chips in their mouth and you know, make this whole birth thing a process and an ordeal. Our gals, they just get after it, and they just have babies. And they have babies before we get there. And so if you're, I mean, I'm not kidding. If you're an Israelite, you're just going, yeah, well, you know, who can I tell you? And so what they end up doing is they toss a bunch of the boys into the sea. And they're really trying to control the population this way. Okay. I'm done with two more minutes. This is the setting. This is the backdrop. God has made promises. I've given you a land, but they're not in the land. I've promised you a lot of numbers, and you are a lot of numbers, but you're slaves. And you're oppressed, and your oppressors are killing your sons. And this is not over a week. This is over centuries. This is a long, long period of time. And if you're a person of faith, the question is, God, when? When is this going to happen? When is this going to happen? Most of the people, as it turns out, are not people of faith. They've long since given up on God's promises. But this is the setting. They're oppressed. Egypt really doesn't know what to do with them. They want them all gone, but at the same token, they want to keep them around. So they're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. And Israel's just getting beat up. That's the whole drill. That's the whole story. Next week, we are introduced to the prominent figure in the book of Exodus, Moses. He is the guy, as unlikely as he is, who God raises up to be the deliverer. He and Joshua. And we'll get to both of them a little later. Next week, I will not be as long. I promise. But I feel that this backdrop is important. I feel that this context is critical. At the very beginning of the Bible, God makes promises. Is he going to keep them? And if he's going to keep them, how is he going to keep them? Is the God of Israel a God of his word? And that's the question that the book of Exodus asks. Last thing, I hate preachers that do that because then I lie. The best way to describe the movement in the book of Exodus is from slavery to worship. One third of the book is about how God's people worship the God that kept his promises. But right now, we're in slavery. We got a bunch of unbelieving people, as we'll see in just a few days. But they're going to be delivered and God's going to be faithful. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time together. I ask that it would be of justice to what we've done. And I pray, Lord, that we would enjoy this journey together through Exodus and that we would see the promises that you make and the promises that you keep. Lord, thank you for this time and for these good folks' attention. And in Christ's name we pray.